Hello and welcome to a new war discussion panel on Russians with Attitude. Major advancements and cauldrons are back on the menu, boys. We will tell you all about what happened in the last 1.5 weeks. The most up-to-date summary of the events as of 26th of June. Here's our agenda for today. Lithuanian blockade of Kaliningrad. Gorsky cauldron that isolated over 2,000 Ukrainian soldiers. Russians taking Severodonetsk. American shipments of HIMARS to the theater of war. Did it change anything? And Ukrainians' attempts at a counterattack in the southern front of Kherson and in the east on Uglidar direction. So let's start.
Right, of course, the most important things happening right now are the advances in Lugansk Oblast, which have been faster than I expected them to be. First of all, the encirclement in Zolotoyengorske, which we talked about, has been completed by Russian and Lugansk People's Republic forces taking Mirnaya Dolina, Podlesnaya, Laskutovka, and Raya Alexandrovka. This is the result of advancements from Tashkovka and the continuing northern advance from Popasnaya through Vrubovka, which cut off the road between Zolotoye and Lysychansk, so basically isolating Lysychansk from the south, where fighting is also already happening on the outskirts of the city. And it encircled the Ukrainian troops at Gorsk and Zolotoye. These are both very heavily fortified positions. Connoisseurs of the 2014 Donbas War probably remember Zolotoye. It is a fortified district in the same vein as Avdiivka, Popasnaya, Marienka. So a frontal assault would have been basically suicidal. Instead, those were encircled and are by now being mopped up, basically. We don't know exactly how many Ukrainian soldiers were still at their positions in Gorsk and Zolotoye. There have been reports that a bunch of them fled out of before the encirclement was completed through the village of Stepnoye, where they took casualties from their own minefields that they had led. Those might have been actually like 2014-2015 era minefields, I'm not sure. But in any case, it was quite demoralizing for the Ukrainian troops. Russian flag has already been raised at the administration building in Gorske. They took a bunch of trophies, Western weapons, a bunch of prisoners who mostly surrendered without a fight. But we don't have precise numbers on how many those are there. There are contradictory reports. Some say that most have actually abandoned the positions there. Some say that around 800 have been taken prisoner. I think we just have to wait for a while before we get precise numbers. But in any case, the cauldron is, from a strategic point of view, liquidated, doesn't exist anymore, and which has great implications for the Russian advance in the rest of Lugansk Oblast, which is basically by now only Lysychansk and its suburbs. In the meanwhile, Severodonetsk has been completely captured, including the industrial zone and the complete east bank of the Seversky Donets River. Like I've said on Twitter before, I'm not sure if if the Russians will cross the river to attack Lysychansk. You have to understand that Lysychansk and Severodonetsk are basically a twin cities. It's one agglomeration, and if I remember correctly, originally one used to be part of the other, but I don't remember which one. Kind of like a Budapest type thing. In any case,
well, Lysychansk seems to be bigger.
Yes, Lysychansk is larger. So I guess Severodonetsk used to be part of Lysychansk administratively, but I don't remember exactly. In any case, it seems some Ukrainian troops broke out of Severodonetsk and crossed the river on foot or like in boats. In any case, they abandoned their heavy equipment mostly.
And it was done in a weirdly quick fashion. There is also a story that Zelensky had a falling out of sorts with Zaluzhny, who is the commander-in-chief of FAU. I'm not sure if it's true, of course, but there are talks that Zelensky apparently demanded that Ukrainian army must stay and defend Severodonetsk to the last Ukrainian, but Zaluzhny commanded the quick retreat instead.
Yes, there have also been some weird reports about the deputy minister of defense of Ukraine, Hanna Mahler. She implied that the retreat from Severodonetsk failed because Ukrainian media reported on the abandonment of Severodonetsk before the operation had actually begun. So, and because of this, apparently, it all had to commence in a very disorganized manner and under Russian fire.
There was probably an idea that it was like a bait strategy, like the usual Ukrainians, you retreat, and then they cover this whole area with artillery. I don't think that in this instance it turned out so well.
Aside from that, as I already said, the whole east bank of the river, including Barovskaya, Voronezh, and Sirotino, has been taken, the Severodonetsk airport as well. So basically the front line is now directly on the river, on the east, and on the south, the road, I think it was the P-66 or R-66, I don't remember, road from Gorske to Lysychansk is fully under Russian control. There have been attacks on Belaya Gora. I am not sure what the exact status of Belaya Gora is right now, but in any case, fighting has already moved further than Belaya Gora and is occurring on the industrial zone in the southern part of Lysychansk. At the same time, there have been advances further west from the direction of Rubovka. There are attempts to seize Verkhna Kamenka, which is a small town next to the Lysychansk oil refinery. In any case, this is a huge industrial area, of course. There will probably be some severe fighting there, but on the other hand, there should be no civilians there. So those can't be used as human shields, and it will probably be not as much of a clusterfuck as Azovstal was. If this advance continues, the road from Lysychansk to Seversk and south are already under Russian fire control. So it's not possible to retreat from Lysychansk or to supply Lysychansk without getting in the range of Russian artillery. This means that effectively there is already an what the Russian military calls an operative encirclement, which is not a physical encirclement in the sense that it is impossible to go through there without running into Russian troops, but everything is in firing range and there is no way to...
It's impossible to get out alive.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you think it's possible that a new cauldron will erupt with Seversk, Russian armed forces capturing Seversk and isolating the whole Lysychansk?
I'm not sure they're going to go for Seversk right now. I think not. I think they will try to seize the oil refinery and Verkhna Kamenka and just cut off the roads. And basically the only thing that will be left is some very rural areas between the river and the oil refinery. I think there is still no river crossing at Bilogorovka, so it will be like the hard way. They have to go like, I think, around 10 miles if after the oil refinery. I'm not sure how many Ukrainian troops remain in the area or how much artillery they have concentrated there.
The toughest weapon that Ukrainians have is the river Seversky Donets still.
Yes, yes. I mean, it has been crossed and at several points already at this point. So it's not, yeah. As I joked, the Russian military has leveled up enough to unlock the crossing rivers perk on the skill tree.
Yeah, but still the Russian controlled territory corresponds to the Seversky Donets a lot.
Yes, yes, of course. I mean, and it's very hard to cross rivers in this kind of warfare where artillery is the main weapon. Both sides have access to precision-guided munitions, and the Ukrainians have complete access to very sophisticated recon and surveillance satellites, drones. Drones especially have basically made the fog of war obsolete on a tactical operational level, so it's just impossible to attempt to cross a river without being discovered if the enemy is thorough. So,
And there are no bridges, right?
yes, there are no more bridges left, I think, on that side of the river, or in that area, there are no more functional bridges left. So it has been to be pontoon bridges. To create pontoon bridges, you have to assemble a lot of vehicles in one point to cross quickly, so you don't have to waste a lot of time at the crossing. But concentrating a lot of vehicles is a very juicy target for enemy artillery. So yeah, it's just crossing rivers is hard. It has always been hard historically, and right now, when the enemy can see you at any time, it's especially hard. So yeah, it is what it is.
Yeah.
So I don't think the Russian military is going to go for Seversk as of yet. They will definitely try to cut off the Lysychansk-Seversk road and the Lysychansk-Bakhmut highway, with in the sense of physically cutting it off. There have been reports. I haven't seen much visual evidence, so I'm not sure how large it really was. But supposedly there was a retreat attempt from Lysychansk. Maybe unauthorized, not sure. But in any case, there have been reports that the Ukrainians have gotten into some kind of highway of death situation upon leaving Lysychansk, and a convoy was completely destroyed when trying to get out of the city because Russian artillery controls all the roads. So what we're gonna see is an encirclement of Lysychansk, or an almost encirclement of Lysychansk. And then attacks from multiple directions, probably not across the river, I believe, because again, there are no functional bridges in that area, and crossing is hard, and crossing into a well-fortified urban area is doubly hard. It's kind of a Stalingrad Light situation. It's not a very pleasant way of waging war. So I believe instead they will attack from the south and the west instead of the east, while keeping artillery on the east bank and firing into Lysychansk. I think there are not super many civilians left in the city. It used to have a population of over 100,000, I believe, according to that French report I shared on Twitter, where French reporters went into the city. There are around 15,000 civilians left. I hope that more will evacuate until proper fighting begins. But yeah, we're gonna have to wait and see. In any case, the implications are rather large here, the strategic implications. If Lysi or when Lysychansk falls, that will more or less, or not more or less, it will mean that the Lugansk Oblast has been completely captured, and the territory that the Lugansk People's Republic claims is completely under Republican control. From then on, the second part of the Slavyansk offensive will come into effect. I believe that the Ukrainians will try to build a defensive line, basically along the highway from Siversk to Solidar to Bakhmut. But I don't think that they will be very successful at holding these lines, and that those will collapse rather quickly, and then they will retreat along what is going to be the price of the whole Donbas offensive, namely Slavyansk-Kramatorsk, the huge agglomeration that is a gigantic fortress that will be besieged. I think they will, think we've already talked this about the banana or the turd. Slavyansk-Kramatorsk, Druzhivka-Konstantinovka, that will be the last stand of the IFU in Donetsk Oblast, in any case. It would probably be smart to, now changing fronts, to attack from the south as well, Uglidar, where there has been some Ukrainian movement lately. The IFU has successfully pushed the Donetsk People's Militia out of Pavlovka, which is directly south of Uglidar. And they have tried to attack Yegorovka, which is a bit further south, just down the road. This attack was unsuccessful. The Ukrainians were pushed back and had to retreat back into Pavlovka and Ugledar under massive artillery fire. And the next day there were massive airstrikes in Ugledar. According to DPR reports, the front line has stabilized there, and there have been so far no more Ukrainian attempts at attacking. But it's not impossible to imagine that they would try to basically push into the flank there and try to maybe attack Volnovakha. If you remember, Volnovakha was one of the first major battles of the war. It is an important logistical and transport hub. It opens the highway to Mariupol. It basically, Volnovakha is the hub that connects Donetsk to Mariupol. So maybe they would, it's imaginable that they would throw some reserves there because there are very few DPR troops stationed there in the region, although I think they have some troops that had been fighting in Mariupol have been moved to Volnovakha to secure this area. So I'm not sure if the Ukrainians have enough troops there to stage any kind of attack that might be successful. But that would definitely be a worthy strategic goal, not just to cut communications in the DPR, to get the Russian and the Donbass militaries to divert troops from Lugansk Oblast.
Actually, let's entertain one possibility. If you were a commander-in-chief of FAU, what would you do in this situation?
Right now.
Right now, yes.
I would immediately pull back all troops from Lysychansk and the Lugansk Oblast. Probably abandon Seversk as well. It's not very defensible.
Keep and some... surrender.
No, I would keep troops at Solidar and Bakhmut to not allow the really the to basically to keep the front line a bit longer than it has to be, and quickly build up the banana of doom from Slavyansk to New York. In the south, probably try to attack in several directions just to divert forces from Donbass.
I think that's what they're doing at Ugledar also. So.
Yes. I think that's what they're trying. It's not a bad strategy. It depends on if they have enough troops there and enough artillery for this. But I don't really think they do. But it would definitely be, if they had enough reserves for it not to be a suicide mission, it would definitely be a smart play right now to attack Volnovakha. And because that would really endanger the southern flank of Donetsk as well.
Yeah, they were also doing just that at not the front line, but attacking the border guards in Kharkiv Oblast, in Sumy. Yeah, because the border guards of Russia have never really been trained and they don't have enough heavy weapons to defend themselves.
Yes, I think that was the point of the whole Kharkiv counteroffensive thing, because... like the push to the border thing, it's strategically irrelevant because
but it's a diversion.
It's a diversion, yeah. And yes, that. So if I were the commander in chief of the AFU, I would just probably pull back from Kharkiv Oblast into Kharkiv itself, because it's. I mean, basically some larger strategic retreats on several fronts. I would try to stabilize the situation in Nikolaev Oblast and not waste time on the attacks directly south of Nikolaev to Kherson. I would probably try to stabilize the situation further east in Nizhnegorovka, where there have been some isolated attempts at attacks, but not really. They just threw a lot more into the Kherson meat grinder, where they just died basically without achieving anything of note. At the same time, it's probably the easiest way to push the Russian army back behind the Dnieper would be north of Snegurevka, so basically somewhere between Snegurevka and Nikopol, just to push the Russians back beyond the river, because that is a would be a defensive position for the AFU.
Yeah.
But all that assumes the presence of viable reserves and communications, logistics, artillery, and so on, which the Ukrainians are all having trouble with. So I
And
don't
high
think.
enough motivation
Yeah,
of the
so I don't
soldiers.
think it's really a matter of the Ukrainian military brass being stupid. They just don't have the resources.
They also attempted the counterattack in Kherson.
Yes, which had no noticeable results.
Yeah, there
Basically,
is a joke circulating in the Russian internet. Zelensky is asking his commanders, "Guys, have you taken Kherson yet?" And they reply, "Not exactly, sir. We have only managed to capture here." The joke is that the here means dick in Russian. So, is it that bad?
propaganda victory in Kherson Oblast, which the Ukrainians have been talking about, was the capture of Kisilovka, which was disproven, decisively disproven yesterday by Roman Saponkov just going there and filming and, well, showing that there is no AFU in Kisilovka. He said that the front line is 11 kilometers away from Kisilovka, which means that the front line is south of Posad-Pokrovskoye, where it has been since April. That means that the Ukrainian Kherson counteroffensive hasn't managed to achieve anything. So, yes, that's what the situation looks like in Kherson. Aside from that, what else do we have? Kharkiv. I don't think there has been anything big happening in Kharkiv lately. Russians are trying to. I don't know if those are real attacks or just recon and force, but there has been some movement in the direction of Stary Saltov. They have also stabilized the front line, recaptured some of the positions before the last pullback. Every night there are Iskander missiles flying into Kharkiv. So yeah, basically the pressure is there. But aside from that, the Ukrainians are still trying to some isolated attacks against the area between Izyum and Balaklea to disrupt Russian supply lines. But I don't think there have been any notable results. One notable thing about this area is that reportedly the first use of the HIMARS system occurred there, south of Izyum. When they fired at a military hospital, the admin of Telegram channel Starshe Ede was there. He witnessed the
His
attack.
UAS was destroyed, right?
Yes, his car was destroyed, a bunch of cars got destroyed, two people were killed, and several people were wounded. So.
Let's talk about American HIMARS, or High Mobility Artillery Rocket Systems. They are now being shipped to Ukraine and are already firing in Donbas. Ukrainian elites are basically hooting and hollering, and on our side there is a bad trend of either underestimating your enemies and technologies. There is also a reactionary counter trend of overestimating foreign technologies and armies. That's what Ukrainians generally do. And we need to find the middle ground and eat the reality pill. So, what do you think about the comparisons of, let's say, American HIMARS to Uragan?
Well, the HIMARS is not a magical weapon, right? Regular MLRS, it's not bad. It's a bit better than the Uragan. It's a bit worse than Smerch or worse than Tornado. I'm not sure which rockets the US is supplying. If they are
Yeah.
supplying the M30, M31 rockets, those have a range of 70 kilometers and they are quite precise. So those are pretty good. If they send the old M26 rockets, the range is between 30 and 45 kilometers, depending on the modification. There has been some panic posting on Russian Telegram about HIMARS having a range of 300 kilometers. But that is just a misunderstanding. It's HIMARS has a range of 300 kilometers if you remove the rockets and put one ATA CMS rocket on it. So yeah, then it becomes kind of like an Tochka or Iskander thing. The US hasn't been producing ATACMS rockets since 2007, although I think a small batch was produced in 2019. And the replacement, I forgot what it's called, the replacement that is planned for the ATACMS, because those are quite old, is not yet ready. It's not yet deployed in the army. So yeah, the ATACMS rockets, or what we in Russia call an OTRK, operational tactical missile system. So basically an equivalent of the Iskander. Although it's a bit worse than the Iskander, I believe it's somewhere between the Ukrainian Tochka-U and the Iskander. So nothing supernatural either. It just depends on how much anti-air is in the region, but all the means to shoot down ATACMS are there. But the problem here is not that like the HIMARS is a bad system or whatever. It's okay. It's a pretty good MLRS. It's more or less the equivalent of Smerch, I guess, with or a bit worse than Smerch, but it has better precision because of the GPS guided stuff. But we don't know how much of the electronics will really end up in Ukrainian hands because the M777 field artillery, it also, the best thing about it is the electronic system, but the US have delivered them without the electronic GPS guidance, so they are not super useful. The Canadians have sent 4 M777 systems with the guidance system included, so those are pretty good. It's not significantly better than what the Ukrainians had at the beginning of the war, and it's just not enough to replace the firepower. The Americans have sent, I think, 4 and are gonna send another 4. They only have 400 of them themselves, I think. They can't really afford to send too many, and it doesn't even begin to replace the losses of MLRS and artillery systems that the Ukrainian military has suffered. Officially, at the beginning of the war, the Ukrainians had around 150 Uragan systems, almost 100 Smerch systems, and almost 200 Grad systems. Having 100 Uragans is a lot better than having 20 HIMARS, even if the HIMARS are better than the Uragans. Because the problem here is firepower, the problem is supply, the problem is how many shells per square mile you have, basically. And higher precision will. It is effective, of course. They can strike like HQs. They can strike supply lines with this. It's not useless. It's not useless at all. It's a great weapon to have, especially for free. But it's just not enough to strategically change anything.
It might be a big advertisement for Lockheed and Martin.
Yeah. I mean, most of what is happening. Most of the weapons delivery stuff and all the discourse about Western magic weapons is are just ads for like Lockheed Martin, Bay Systems, Bell and so on, Bell Textron and so on, who produce this stuff. And there has been some chatter about the Turks being mad about Bayraktar's underperforming, and there have been rumors about them like banning the Ukrainians from using Bayraktars in Donbas because they just get shot down all the time and no one will buy them. Despite that, the price has shot up like 500%.
Is there any data about Smerch system? How many of them are available for Russia? Because that's the subject of interest, the quantity. And also I believe that the HIMARS are more modern than basically anything that Russia has in large enough quantities, of course. It's an interesting topic, actually, the Russian-American military comparisons and
Yes,
the holy wars around it.
So Russia has around, I think, 100 Smerch systems and around 900 Uragans, although 700 of them were in deep storage. I don't know how many of them have been pulled out. And I'm not sure how many Tornado systems. I think around somewhere around 30. And Tornado is, of course, a very great system. It's from barely 10 years old. And
Well,
I
yeah,
think.
but It's not 500 that US.
Yes,
has.
Yes, of course, of course, and of course we're yeah the grads. Russia has a shit ton of grads. I'm not actually sure how many. Let me check it out. How many grads?
Well, it's a system from the 50s, right?
Yes, yes.
It's effective.
There are 2,500.
Oh no! All right.
I mean, it has a very limited range for this type of system, but it is very effective. Still, the maximum firing range is around 40 kilometers, I believe, which is not a lot less than other more modern systems, except the Tornado, which is the largest range of the systems we discussed, but there are just not that many Tornado systems in the Russian military yet.
It's actually the echo of the Cold War arms race between the US and USSR, because it's interesting to explore it. Back then we had a clear high degree of mutual respect. Both of the industries had its own share of genius, engineering, the strengths, its own weaknesses, and eternal debates have appeared. What is better, SU-35 or F-35 or AK or M-16, and this conflict basically has sparked some fire that still is burning in the hearts of engineers and the militaries and the armchair commandos to this
day.
Well,
one thing this conflict has certainly done is completely vindicate the Soviet strategy of just producing a fuck ton of artillery shells and all other kinds of munitions, which NATO has ridiculed the Soviet Union and Russia for decades. But now it turns out that the Ukrainians are running out of artillery shells. The West isn't producing 152mm shells. And it's a logistical nightmare to get enough 155mm shells into Ukraine. And they don't have enough themselves. It's a matter just of how you divert basically industrial capacity. I don't know how many shells Russia is producing nowadays, but the Soviet stocks are just, well, they are basically infinite, functionally.
Yeah. And this is a war of patience. But yeah, it's ironic that HIMARS was totally influenced by the Soviet insistence on MLRS systems. Of course, it's not their Soviet creation, but the world was basically amazed by Katyusha, but it was also a joint effort, right? Because Katyusha has only become very important when its artillery top was mounted on the American truck, the Studebaker, that was sent thanks to Lend-Lease. Americans and the Soviets have created the modern warfare in this regard. But
yes, of course, it's also like a question of doctrine. I mean, the HIMARS are not miracle systems because MLRS have never been a focus of the American military-industrial complex. It's just not something that is super important to the U.S. military doctrine. So it's logical that it's not really like super duper amazing in comparison to other systems. But yes.
I mean, its strength in the variety and the smart electronic guided missiles
are more
dangerous.
Yes, the aiming system. The aiming system is good, of course. The aiming system is great, but
I heard that reload time is also faster on American HIMARS.
Possible, yeah.
And also a point. There is a caveat that M142 HIMARS were made in the 90s, and in the 90s. The arms race has stopped because meanwhile in Yeltsin's Russia all we have developed was AIDS and gay clubs and heroin epidemic. So it's like the arms race was in the good times of Soviet tech was a race of two athletes that ran perfectly. It was beautiful, and suddenly one of them tripped over its own dick and fell to the pavement and shitted itself, whereas the American athlete, heavily influenced by the other, carried on. I think it's about 15 years that Russian military industries have been revived to some extent. And now We are trying to close the gap of lost progress in the 90s, right? So, Lithuania blocking most of the shipments through its territory to the Russian enclave of Kaliningrad, former Königsberg, Eastern Prussia, which is pretty also ironic because one of the reasons behind the Second World War was exactly that. The land bridge that would connect Germany and East Prussia. This is like the cursed land that triggers all the world wars, and Lithuania is doing its best to ensure it. So what do you think about who is pulling the strings here?
I'm kind of on team nothing happens here, because to me, from the diplomatic reactions, it's kind of obvious that Lithuania did not clear this with Brussels, and the EU is not super like happy about getting in a dancing corridor situation with Russia right now by blockading a city, which is an act of war, technically.
If it wasn't the EU, who commanded Lithuania to do it?
Well, who? I think it's the British and the Americans. The British have a lot of power in the Baltics, and Baltic defense is basically completely dependent on America. Lithuania has something like 30,000, I think, men in their army. So they wouldn't do anything without like NATO or at least British American approval. And
so yeah. Is it just a provocation, or do you think there is a larger endgame?
I'm not sure what they're trying to achieve here, to be honest.
Slightly EU hurt has Kaliningrad economy.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, one Lithuanian member of the European Parliament has complained that the EU is working on a document that would specifically allow shipments of sanctioned goods from Russia to Russia. So through EU territory, so basically from mainland Russian Federation to Kaliningrad, that would go through Lithuanian territory. I guess they don't want this to happen, but I'm not sure what they want. It's always difficult to understand if something that the Baltic states do is something that the Baltic states want to do or something the Americans told them to do. It's another one of those sovereign democracy moments where these countries are basically geopolitically acting as puppet states. And it's not in the interest of Lithuania to get into a conflict with Russia over this. But they have been doing this kind of stuff for 30 years, so.
Yeah, there was also a thing, the Suwalski Gap.
Yes,
right.
Yes, the Suwalki corridor. The Suwalki Gap, it is a theoretical corridor, basically connecting Russia and mainland Russia and Kaliningrad Oblast, going through the area, the border area of Lithuania and Poland.
Yeah, and so it also sparked the debates in the Russian sphere about the region of Lithuania that belonged to Belarus, actually, and the communists gave Lithuania this region. How was it called again?
Well, the city of Vilnius was given to Lithuania by
but I mean from Belarus.
I'm not sure which part that was. Probably north of Ivia, I guess, but I'm not sure.
So after some break, the missile strikes over Kyiv have resumed. So what do you think the Russian army is trying to achieve by striking Kyiv again?
Well, they have fired at the Artom factory, which was repairing tanks, I believe. It has already been targeted before, a few months ago, so I guess they repaired it and set up an impromptu workshop there again. I guess they thought that Russia would not strike Kyiv anymore, and that's why they put up military infrastructure there again, is my guess. But yeah, but to be honest, I think what's more interesting than the missile strikes in Kyiv, although it's also interesting that they have resumed after, I think, a month or around a month of no strikes in Kyiv itself, is the strike on the bridge in Cherkasy Oblast. It is a bridge, but firstly, it's a dam. It's part of the hydraulic structure there. And the strike against it is not only a blow to the transport infrastructure, but also kind of, I think, a warning about central Ukraine and what Russia could possibly do.
They
There,
shouldn't relax, is the message.
yes, they could theoretically. What they could do is strike the Kaniv hydroelectric power plant and destroy the dam there, which would lead to flooding in Cherkask and Cherkasy, Kirovograd, and Dnipropetrovsk Oblast. And it is one of those things where I'm always amazed that the Ukrainian state has done absolutely nothing with what it has inherited from the Soviet Union. In Ukrainian media and the academic community as well, this has been discussed for years, that the whole hydropower and hydrotechnical construction things, or rather their safety, is that no one has done anything for 30 years about the dams, about all the power plants. It's like the Soviet engineers left and no one took over. And an interesting point is that the Ukrainians have lately created a fleet of civilian boats taken over by the military and equipped with heavy weapons, who basically patrol the Dnieper River, which is definitely a smart thing to do. I would have done the same in their place. But if Russia were to strike the Kaniv Dam and flood the area, the Dnieper flotilla would become useless, and they would not be able to cover Kiev anymore and supply Dnipropetrovsk and Nikolaev. So that might be an interesting, like, thing to do. I'm not
Those
sure
boats
if
will
Russia.
become submarines.
Yes, I'm not sure if Russia is willing to go that far. That depends on the situation on the front lines, of course. But it's definitely a thing they could do. And considering, I think this is the first Russian strike on a dam. I mean, they didn't destroy the dam; they just destroyed the railway part of the bridge, which in itself is. I'm always astounded at how precise those calibers are.
What range does the caliber has again? And from where do you think they're firing it?
The Kaliber missile has an operational range of up to 2,500 kilometers. The Kaliber M missile, which is currently under development, will have a range of 4,500 kilometers. Although I'm not sure that it was a Kaliber strike, it might have been other rockets. I think actually I heard somewhere that they used a very old rocket for this one, namely the Ha-22. From the 60s or so, which has a range of only 600 kilometers. I think they are kind of mixing it up. I'm not sure why and how. Sometimes they use the super great rockets from the Caspian Sea, which cover like immense range to strike targets in Ukraine. I mean, the Caspian Sea, if you just look at the Ukrainian border, the furthest western part of the Caspian Sea is around 1,000 kilometers away from the front lines right now. And to strike targets, they would probably, it's probably even more, it's probably up to 1,500 or something. So that is pretty amazing, to be honest. But the strikes from the Caspian Sea are probably the Kaliber missiles. Aside from that, they often use 222 and the 222 plane, which is a bomber plane, a heavy supersonic bomber plane, quite old actually, from the 60s. And what's actually interesting is that I think it was the 2160, the White Swan. Those are from the 80s, also supersonic strategic bombers that can drop both bombs and missiles. They are based in Engels, And they are part of a military unit that is, well, it's the 22nd Guards Heavy Bomber Aviation Division, and it bears the name Donbaske. So I thought that was quite interesting, the Donbass Division.
The reason why they mix the super modern stuff with Soviet is to get rid of the junk, I think, the utilization of
Yeah, I
Soviet
think so too. I
rockets
think so
program.
too.
It's better to use them somehow than to let them just rot in
I mean, I
the
think
some
they
storage.
often use them to like de-ice rivers in Siberia and
Oh
the
yeah.
Far East. The old bombs, the FAPs.
But it's better to destroy some bridges in
Yes, of
Cherkasy.
course.
But also about HIMARS possibly reaching the 300 kilometers range. The reason for Ukrainian rejoicing is that it's exactly 280 kilometers from, say, Kharkiv to Voronezh. So it's possible to shell a very large Russian city with it. But yeah,
Yes, or
how.
the possibly the Crimean Bridge.
Crimean Bridge also, yeah, it's a possibility, and much more important than that, because let's check. Let's say, for example, from Dnieper, it's about 350 kilometers from Dnieper, and I believe it's the closest point that they now have.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's out of reach, sadly, for poor Ukrainians. Okay, well. It certainly has been an interesting week and a half
Also, by the
active.
way, just coming in, apparently the National Interest reports that from 108 M777 howitzers that the Ukrainians have gotten, only 34 are operational right now. The rest have either been destroyed or damaged. I've actually read complaints from the Ukrainians that the M777 systems are extremely fragile, and they have to be get repaired very often and just randomly break and stuff like that. I'm not sure how true that is. Maybe some of our listeners who have personal experience with this artillery system can tell us in
Well, it's a matter of perspective. If you're used to Soviet stuff, and
Yeah, that's
then,
true.
yeah, maybe for our Western listeners, it's all right. But yeah, we will keep you updated every single 2 weeks period, let's say that. I believe there will be a new sea trap because the war is far from over, but the advancements are very rapid. And yeah, who knows what the future will bring. Thank you for listening and see you soon.